This is Susanna McMonagle, and you're listening to Season 3 of the 5 to 8 Shift podcast for parents. The 5 to 8 Shift podcast and community exists to educate, inspire, and encourage parents throughout their parenthood adventure. Here, we talk about all the things impacting parents today, everything from mental health to technology to faith, teenagers, toddlers, self-care routines, and so much more. We know parenting is tough work, but family life is worth every ounce of effort. We hope you listen in, share with your favorites, and are reminded that you're not alone. We look forward to cheering you on in your own 5 to 8 shift. It's the most important shift of the day. Hey everyone, this is your host Susanna. Welcome to another episode of the 5 to 8 shift. I am thrilled to have a great guest for you guys today. So what we're doing today is having our third installment of the Tech and Family series. I hope you guys are enjoying it. If you haven't listened to our other two episodes, we had an interview with Letitia Barr of Tech Savvy Mama and also Devorah Heitner, who does a lot of writing in this space, PhD, fantastic researcher. And so today I have Anya Kemenetz, and she is the author of two great books. So she wrote a book in 2018 called The Art of Screen Time. That is wonderful. And she had another book actually come out just a couple weeks ago called The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. And so Anya has been a correspondent for NPR. She does a lot of writing for some of the key outlets that you guys know and love. And she's written a couple books along the way. And so our conversation today is based really on both of her books, The Art of Screen Time, where we talk about things like why, how much time your kid is spending online might not be the most important measurement, and how we can really teach our kids to have good habits and to think intentionally on what we're doing online, and how we can move to setting good habits and really correcting potentially negative ones, stepping in as a parent, working alongside your kid. And then her most recent book, The Stolen Year, is absolutely fascinating. And what it does is it looks at the big picture context of how children have really been changed because of COVID. And I shared some stories as a college professor about, you know, we went back to school in the classroom in the fall of 2020, and I had higher expectations for my kids. And really, they were willing, than they were able to meet. And a lot of that had, you know, they had just gotten a crazy year under their belt, and then this whole thing happened again. And so Anya talks about social deficits brought on by COVID and how we as parents can really manage that. She talked about some of the leadership in our country and how she feels that that sort of left some of our most vulnerable populations really without great options. We talked about mental health after the pandemic, why parents should go to board meetings, and really her book is about resilience for families. So Anya is so smart. Her writing is fantastic. The book is wonderful, The Stolen Year. And so I really encourage you to check her out, check out her books. And I hope you guys enjoy today's episode. As always, if you want to help this podcast, share with your friends on your socials and in real life. And we'd love your review. We love your review on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast. So thanks for being here. Y'all have a great day. Everybody, welcome to another episode of the 5 to 8 Shift. I am thrilled to have Anya on my podcast today, and we are going to talk about some of her recent projects and some of the work she is doing to help us learn more about family life and the impact of COVID and screens and all of these things that us moms are thinking about all the time. And so, Anya, I am going to have you, Anya Kemenetz, right? Did I say that right?
Yes, you did. Thanks.
Okay. I'm going to start by asking you five sort of rapid fire questions to have you introduce yourself. Does that work for you?
Sounds great.
Okay. The first one is, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Louisiana. I lived in Baton Rouge until I was 14, and then we moved to New Orleans.
Okay. All right. And then where do you live now?
I live in Brooklyn, in northern Brooklyn, New York.
Okay. So you are a long way from home.
Yes. Yes.
Although Brooklyn's your home now and has been for some time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been here since college.
Okay, awesome. What is one of your favorite foods or restaurants? And I know there are lots of good restaurants in your neck of the woods, so that could be tough.
That's so hard. Oh my God. I really, really love Thai food, but where we're living now, we have a really good neighborhood Korean restaurant, so we go there a lot.
Okay, that sounds delicious.
Yeah.
If you could only have one for the next year, would you choose movies or music?
Wow, that is a tough one.
I had to, and you're not allowed to say I'm gonna watch music videos. You have to pick
Yeah,
one or the
right.
other.
Oh my God. I guess I would, it's so hard, but I think I'd pick movies because my husband and I just really love going to the movies and my kids also love movies. So I'm gonna go for that. I'm gonna be sad when I'm running and sad when I'm dancing. I'm just gonna be dancing to like quiet, I guess.
One of those silent disco, you see the
Yeah.
people with the headphones, but you'll
Exactly.
watch some great movies for the year. Okay, well, hopefully that doesn't happen.
Yes.
And so today you're talking to us about a couple different projects. Let's start with you wrote a book that came out a couple years ago called The Art of Screen Time. And the last question I want to ask you here as part of your intro is, when did you first consider writing about that topic? Did you have sort of like a personal aha moment, or was it something that you were seeing again and again and you're like, you know what, I gotta learn more about this?
I would say it's more the latter. I had been interested in technology and I covered technology for a magazine. And when the mobile devices came out, when the first iPhone came out, I just saw that they were everywhere. I saw them in little kids' hands. I saw them in strollers. I saw them out at restaurants. And I knew, wow, this is a quiet revolution that's taking place in childhood.
Yeah, and it really hasn't stopped since, has it?
That's right. That's right.
All right, and you, so let's start by talking about this book, The Art of Screen Time. So your book is, I love the way that, and for my listeners, I mean, you have written for all kinds of publications. You do a lot in the education sector, and you've done that for some time now. So your book contains a lot of excerpts from both researchers and then also parents, which I love because it's a nice blend there. But what is one of the biggest discrepancies that you remember, or what's a gap between like what researchers are saying and what parents are saying when it comes to this sort of like account or information on screens and families?
Honestly, I feel like it's right there in the title, which is that time is the most important measurement. And I actually do fault the doctors for saying that because they were the American Academy of Pediatrics. They came out with this famous 2-hour rule.
Yes.
And we all know what it is. And then, so I still, this is the biggest question that I get when I speak to parents, how much time is too much? And no matter how many times we turn it around and say, look, it's about your relationship to the device. It's about the routine of your day. It's about bedtime. It's about are you eating meals together as a family, looking each other in the eye? It's about your kids' social skills. It's about their physical skills. Putting a timer on that thing is not going to solve those problems. And I
Yeah.
wish that it did. I wish it was that simple.
Yeah. No, you're right. And it's a little arbitrary, I guess, in some ways. And I feel like, but like as parents, we're always looking for like, ooh, I don't want to say the cheat sheet. But
Yeah, of course, of
when
course.
someone says 2 hours, that's a lot easier than saying, make sure you have a solid relationship with your kid. Like, where's the cheat sheet for that? Right?
Totally. And I mean, there are simple things you can think about in terms of like warning signs. And I did, for example, there's a pediatrician in the book that I quote that kind of is like, you need to turn off the screens an hour before bedtime. You need to have, an hour of physical activity per day. You need to make sure that you're eating a screen-free meal with your kids once per day. So these are the kinds of like there are healthy habits and it's kind of like your plate, right? And we've all like struggled through this, like trying to feed our kids healthy meals and it's always a push and pull and a
Yeah.
power struggle, right? And I wish it like it's not as simple as like 600 calories of this and 600 calories of that. Like you have to be like,
You're
look,
right.
we build the plate, we build the week. We have treats, and that's kind of how I'm trying to get parents to think about screens too.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so in your book, you talk about that there are some measurable negative impacts from too much time on screens. Can you talk to us a little bit about particularly what some of the pediatricians are saying? Like some of that stuff you just mentioned are some of, what are you hearing from the experts?
So I think the relationship between screens and sleep is a really big one to focus on. both when the kids are really little, but also especially for teenagers, because that's when they might be spending a lot of unsupervised time on their screens, is late at night in their bedrooms.
Yeah.
And so they're just a really negative, and we all probably can relate to this, a really negative vicious circle where you're staring at the screen. It's got, you know, stressful content in it or exciting content in it. You might be in a conversation with a friend, yeah, and then hours pass and, oh, I don't feel sleepy. Yeah, you don't feel sleepy because it's straining in your eyes, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. So, I mean, hard relate, right? But as for teenagers, like as much as we have that control, keeping out of the bedroom, buy them an alarm clock. Don't rely on it as a sleep, yes, alarm. You know, charge it outside the bedroom at night, in your own room if you have to. That would be, if you're going to be a hardliner about something, that would be the thing I would hold the line on.
That's interesting. So more so than 2 hours, 9 hours, like, do not let them go to bed with a device. That feels like a very strong theme that you heard up and down.
It really is. And it's the eye researchers, so the people who worry about myopia, the sleep researchers, as well as some of these mental health correlations. You know, a lot of times what looks like a depressed teenager is really a sleep deprived teenager. They might be grumpy. They might be, you know, not a lot of energy for stuff. And we know that our teens, they're not getting the sleep that they need, or almost across the board.
Well, and I feel like screens are only part of the problem of teens not getting enough sleep. So now we add screens in, and that's really kind of compounded in very profound ways, I would imagine.
That's exactly right. Because again, the screens really shortwire the sleep cycle. They make you feel not sleepy. And so I've heard tell and seen kids that wake up throughout the night to respond to messages, you know, because their friends are also messaging them.
Oh my goodness. And it's like, I had somebody else on my podcast, and she talked about kind of like the what was the word she used for it? But like, basically you and all your girlfriends and your kids, like, try to be on the same page, because if there's one kid texting, yeah, in the middle of the night, that's really going to spur on the group in ways where, obviously, if you're all on the same page, might not be happening quite as much anyway.
Yeah. And that brings up another really important point, because the screens are really a big part of where our kids are learning how to socialize, and even more so right in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And the fact is that we can't make it be like Lord of the Flies in there. Like, we can't throw them online without a lot of supervision. They need a little bit of scaffolding.
Yes.
And they, you know, it depends, you know, if you have an 11-year-old and you're giving them your first phone, that you can have this conversation and say, hey, I'm going to look over your shoulder, or, you know, try to overhear what's happening. I actually say that it can be better if the kids are doing voice chat, like with Discord, where they're playing video games, because at least you have a chance to overhear it, and you have a sense of what's going on, versus a text-based chat, which you just have no idea. So if the kids are older and this is going on for a while, they have a little more of an expectation of privacy, I would say take a little bit of a softer approach, because they're not going to take kindly. They're just going to shove it underground and figure out a way to hide it from you. So build in trust and buy-in and say, look, I'm here if you have a situation you don't quite sure how to deal with. Or Lisa Damore, who's an amazing adolescent psychiatrist, specializes in girls, is like, always blame it on me. Like, if you see something you don't like, say, oh my gosh, my mom reads my phone, even if it's not true.
Yeah.
But be that parent that you can be the hard one that if something's going on, that the kid can say, well, I don't want to be involved in this.
Yeah. And, you know, that's twofold. Number one, I love her and I follow her on Instagram, and she is great.
She's fantastic.
But number two, you know, a part of that is just having those conversations beforehand that really set your kids up with some of the, I want to say taglines, but like some of the phrases they can say when they get caught in a place they don't want to be, or a place they weren't, you know, anticipating.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, one of the things, you know, the last thing I kind of want to ask you about this book is, you talk a little bit about habit formation, and you talk about that with really as young as preschool, and that can have sort of set the stage. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's habits in a couple different ways. I mean, it's your kids' habits, but it's also your habits as a parent.
Yes.
You know, how you are willing to kind of set up the situation and set yourself up for success. And so with younger kids, you know, you're using all kinds of things to shape behavior. You might be using a sticker chart. You might be using a timer in the kitchen. You might be using passes that you hand out to kids for a certain amount of time, or you trade it for chores. And you know, that gets less and less as time goes on, but you're building that awareness because what you'd like them to be able to do is have their own internal sense, right? It's like when they are little, you might sort of give them one cookie, but when they're older, you're prompting them to say, well, when am I full? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the same thing. And so you see, again, I analogize it to food because, you know, we don't want kids who are calling you from college to be like, mom, can I have the frozen yogurt?
Right. True.
They need to internalize the sense of limits and what's a healthy balance. And that's what we need to ultimately trust them to do.
Yeah. And so you are convinced that so much of this, not convinced, but like you wrote about like how preschool age, it starts there. And then, you know, and then how do screens come into play there moving forward?
The preschool age with screens? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, mobile devices have been a revolution for this age group because of the, you know, endless availability of short videos and these little apps and games. So with that age group, I mean, time limits do make sense, but we're also interested in content limits because there's a lot of these kinds of apps that are very addictive is a loaded word, but they are just have the an endless chain of engagement and kids need help with that. So I really do focus on slower tech with that young age group. So things like audiobooks, things like coloring apps that aren't full of like bells and whistles. Obviously educational content can be helpful. Common Sense Media is a great resource for
us. Yes, love Common Sense Media.
You know, and so that's kind of the where we start and we kind of go from there.
Okay. And there's, you know, you have lots of great tips in there and you talk about using media together. And so, you know, and I'm a college professor, and so I do some media literacy courses, and I always tell my students, social media is not evil. Like, the television is not evil. Like, your iPad is not evil. It's really how you use it and what you get out of it. And you said that, particularly at the end of the book, about, like, it can be awesome when you have a family movie night, and that's something that you are approaching together. And so, I think building that in your family makes a lot of sense. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. A co-viewing. Thanks for reminding me on that. Like, you definitely want to be involved with your kids' media use. And obviously that's a lot easier to do when they're younger.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and the habit formation, it really got me thinking a lot about your new book, The Stolen Year, which is really interesting. And I read through a lot of it in the last week. And so you have a fabulous way of bringing in the experts, but also like giving a humanizing effect to it. Cause, you know, it's not like a data, you know, you can be overwhelmed with data, and you do an excellent way of sort of putting this in context. So if somebody's like, ooh, what is the stolen year? Like, tell us what that is about.
Yeah. The stolen year is about the impact on children of our response to the pandemic, as well as the pandemic itself here in the United States.
And what grade would you give the United States in our response to the pandemic?
I'll just say this. We have the highest death rate among wealthy nations right now from COVID-19. We lost, you know, obviously tragically over a million people and counting. We also kept our schools closed longer to more students than any other wealthy nation at the same time.
Yeah. And that seems to be a crux of your, you know, what you're writing about, and such a really interesting conundrum, I guess. If there's a mom listening to this podcast right now, which there are, there's hundreds of them. If I'm a mom starting out this school year, all right. Yeah. So this is going to, you know, and I'm saying I have higher expectations for my kids. The pandemic is over. The kids are fine. Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
I would say, I hope your kid is doing great. I'm sure they probably are. And you've seen a lot of growth in them because you're so close to them. We do have to understand that each and every one of our kids went through something very intense. And they were not able to have their normal social opportunities over the past 2 years, no matter how that looked in your community. And so without having an eye to saying that they're damaged in any way, they're also part of a school community that also where there may be kids who don't have the same advantages as your kids.
Right.
And teachers that were under a tremendous amount of pressure and stress. So the whole system's under stress. We can all take some grace. We can all take some patience. And we can all take a spirit of recommitting to making our school and their community the best that it can possibly be. I think there are a lot of kids out there that might have social deficits that might be not immediately visible, especially to a loving parent's eye, because of the time that they missed, even if you're not seeing obvious academic gaps.
Yeah. And
that doesn't mean that they're damaged goods. It means that they might need a little more thoughtfulness about, you know, instead of it being rushing into slumber parties, maybe you're starting with shorter play dates, or instead of a big unstructured kind of birthday party, maybe you're planning a specific activity at the birthday party because some of the kids need a little more time to warm up and figure out how to interact. It's these kind of subtle things. Like, I was reading a report of people were talking about like fifth graders playing duck, duck, goose.
Yeah.
And it's like, they didn't get that time. They missed that time to be together as little kids. And so, great. Okay. So now they get to do that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the whole social deficits, I think, so again, I teach college students, and my students came in last year, and I and they were not on the same page. You know, I'm coming in with, you're 19 and you're fine. And it only took me about 2 weeks to backtrack quite a bit, you know, and it's so interesting that you just said that, Anya. One of my best, I shouldn't say, but like, I was talking about something and I actually brought in some of my preschoolers' toys for my college students. I don't know if you've seen the little plussy box, but there's like plusses and they're so fun. And then I have magnet tiles and I had wooden blocks. So they were like, you know, building things. Mm-hmm. Because they social deficits, I wish I had that word back then, but that's kind of what it was. Like, they weren't, they were disengaged, you know, and I know I'm not so great, but I felt fairly confident it wasn't me, you know, but I knew there was a gap.
Yeah.
And then I brought toys probably 3 or 4 times, and it connected them to each other. Then they're more talkative, then they're more willing. And it was such a gap because they were so behind what I was expecting at 19 even. And so I can only imagine. I mean, where are you seeing this up and down the grade levels?
Absolutely. It's happening up and down the grade levels. It's happening with, you know, very young kids who had almost zero exposure, and it's happening with high school students. I mean, this is totally anecdotal, but my daughter is 10. She was away at summer camp. Her two best friends were each away at different summer camps. Both of them called and tried to come home.
Oh, wow.
Because both of them said, it's classic mean girl, you know, whatever. Yeah. They're going into middle school type of stuff. But like, the fact that they were actually like, I want to come home. Like, that's the difference, you know? And then the parents have to say, well, this is their big opportunity to be with their friends, and I don't really want them to come home, you know? And eventually they didn't, you know? But these are the things that people who deal with kids on a daily basis are telling me, that, you know, they're making up for lost time in all different kinds of ways.
Yeah, and they really are. And so, and again, I just was sort of shocked at the college level. But now that, you know, now that I know more, it's, you know, it's been a year now, I'm not shocked. Or maybe I shouldn't have been then, or I just had high expectations. You know, you wrote in this, the Stolen Year, you talked about schools in the fall of 2020. And I thought that was particularly interesting because, you know, March 2020, okay, it's chaos. Nobody really knows upside down from anything. And we're a couple months into it. And so I'm not shocked now about what you wrote, but it seems a little bit about, some of it was shoved under the rug, you know, in public discourse. Like, can you, you know, like, you, especially in that part, you wrote about how remote learning was really failing a lot of kids and a lot of, you know, disadvantaged kids in particular, low income communities. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about what you found there?
Yeah. Kids didn't sign in for remote learning, and teachers said that they didn't teach as much. And now that the test scores are in, we know that kids didn't learn as much, at least as much as we're able to measure it. And the longer that they were out, the longer they were home, which was higher in low income communities, higher in, communities of color, higher in blue states, the longer they were home, the less that they learned, and the more time it's going to take them to catch up. It was very hard at the time. I think that there was a very loud discourse about what could have been the life and death risks of opening schools.
And
then at the national leadership level, we had this very kind of one note, open the schools, but it wasn't necessarily, this is how we're going to do this safely. This is how we're going to get everyone's trust to do it. Yes. Here's the resources that you need, right? There was emergency money that went out in the spring of 2020 for laptops and things, but there wasn't extra money in the fall for planning for things like ventilation, masks. All of that came much, much later. And so, you know, there were some states that did things differently. But honestly, most of it broke down by political affiliation, where either it was open everything up, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, or it was, well, gosh, we gotta hold on and hold off and see what, you know, see what's really going on here. And in that space, I didn't feel like there was enough really reckoning with the costs and the trade-offs of that choice. And that's kind of why I wrote the book.
Say more. I like that. Say more about some of those trade-offs. I mean, because you're right. There was pushback everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, just on a very basic level, you know, food service, right? There's 30 million kids that get free and reduced price lunches in our country. Way too many hungry kids. And the school lunch programs tried really hard, but they did not, they gave out a fraction of the amount of food that they normally give out. And so in April and May, kids went hungry. You know, there were so issues around, you know, kids that had special needs, special education kids, they're not getting those services. It's literally impossible to deliver those services in many cases. Occupational therapy, how to hold a pencil. You can't do that over Zoom. Nope. Speech therapy, very hard to do over Zoom. So kids just aren't getting those interventions. And, you know, we heard things, and obviously I covered a lot of that as a reporter, but it somehow all the time, sort of the people that said it's too dangerous. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think it's just the overwhelming fear of COVID, the overwhelming fear of the unknown really stood in the way. And the people, and then you had the people who were, it almost seemed like the only way you could be in favor of opening schools was if you didn't think anything should be shut down.
That's right.
Right. But in Europe, they made different choices.
So what did Europe do? Like, give us like the, that was different.
European countries started reopening in the spring of 2020, in April and in May. They were like, we're going to figure this out.
Yeah.
By the fall of 2020, across Europe, Italy, Spain, France, Germany, UK, and Scandinavia, they had their schools open and they said, we are not going to shut down again. We see the toll it's taking. And if we have to, we'll shut down bars, we'll shut down restaurants, outdoor markets, yes, but not schools, not daycares. They just made that very clear choice.
You know, I mean, listen, I love professional sports a lot, but like, you know, we had Eagles games and we had no schools open. There's like 70,000 people, you know, and then Sixers basketball, you know, they put in a new venting system. And I'm like, but then the city of Philadelphia at the end of 2020 in the spring, they said 50% of kids in the Philadelphia school district never logged in. Not once.
Yeah.
Not once.
Yeah. 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 It was egregious, but it wasn't even that unusual.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, now that you look back, you're like, it's a little bit like, what in the world? Sadly, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I think you really bring up some good points about some of these special learning needs and things like that, that really you cannot accommodate in a remote learning system.
No. And that's why there were lots of lawsuits by parents of special needs kids.
So you write about mental health, right? Which we learn more and more about. What do you think? Where's mental health in our kids now? Like, how are we doing in the trajectory? You know, they've come off this tough thing. We realize it was maybe tougher on them than we gave them credit for.
Yeah.
Where are we and what can we do?
I honestly think there's a lot of work ahead because in the very short time frame around the crisis, there can be what's called a pull together effect.
Yep.
And this sort of short term sense. And so we know that suicides didn't go up as much as we'd feared. But things like the horrible rash of school shootings that we've seen, And those are kids that were, I mean, it's the edge, it's the very edge, but there's a whole bunch of kids, right, who were disengaged from school, from services, from friends, and, you know, their lives are going on the wrong track. So, the good part that I see is I do see a huge effort to put in resources towards this and to try to hire people. There's a huge pipeline problem. It existed before the pandemic. There are not enough practitioners.
That's right.
For the number of kids that need it. Yeah. And that's going to take time, but investing in those people and certain school districts are doing things like letting people get trained on the job to be school counselors. Mm. This is what we're going to need. And it's really a generational effort.
Yeah. You know, our school district, I just found out, they're doing some experiments in our elementary school where they're doing, I guess it's job sharing. So there's one teacher in the morning and there's another. And I'm sure it's because there's lots of people who want to work part-time and maybe not full-time, or maybe they have small kids. And so they're just trying to find a solution to, we need a lot more teachers and counselors. And yeah, that pipeline is definitely a big problem for sure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a problem. It's also an opportunity because we do see that schools have received a lot of federal funding and they're trying to invest. I think across the board, school leaders understand this is a problem, that they can't have a successful school unless they have mental wellness across the board.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we sort of wrap up here, what do you want readers of The Stolen Year to walk away with? Like, what is your hope for them when they read this and they learn a whole lot? You know, what are you hoping they walk away with?
I want them to be able, first of all, to help put their own family's experience in a broader perspective and understand where it fit into the national picture, which a lot of people have said is very healing.
Yes.
And then I also really, you know, there's a lot in there about resilience. There's a lot in there about what I call post-traumatic growth, or the science of post-traumatic growth. So how do we grow beyond this and walk that delicate line between, and this is how we are with our kids too. It's like, you know, your kid falls down and they're crying. You're not like, you're okay. You know, and you're not like, oh my God, what happened? You have to be like, huh, you fell down. You know, if it's a serious injury, like, that hurts. Let's see what we can do about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so post traumatic growth here, can you equate what happened in the pandemic to any other experiences these kids have had? Or is this pretty much going to be the big one for now?
Oh my God. I mean, I hope it's the big one.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I mean, this is a very precarious kind of age of the world, right? So we have kids in Ukraine that went straight from the pandemic into a war.
Yeah.
And here around the United States, we've got kids dealing with natural disasters on a daily basis. So the flexibility, the resilience, the ability to respond and have this emotional toolbox, this is something our kids are going to need for their whole lives.
Yeah. You know, and let me just kick it back to something we were talking about earlier. Do you think, or how do I want to say this? Have schools changed, or our education system? Like, are we aware that we could have done better? Are we set up to do better? You know, with or without a pandemic, you know, just supporting kids on the fringes. Has this realized maybe some of the deficiencies, and are we, you know, and I know that's such a big question because some school districts are always doing it better than others, but you know what I mean? Like, have we learned?
Compared to some disasters, and I'm thinking of New Orleans after Katrina, I'm also thinking of Rwanda, which is less well known, but they had a major educational overhaul after their genocide. We are not seeing a major overhaul of the U.S. education system. You know, and I'm sorry to say that. There hasn't been some visionary that's come in. It's really all been about a return to normal status quo. And so if there's going to be major changes going forward, it's honestly going to be parents. And, you know, some policymakers who listen to parents pushing for something a little bit different. I think that the focus on social and emotional learning and relationships is really important. I've also seen a couple of states having success with better methods of reading instruction. So, for example,
interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. This is actually, it's just parallel to the pandemic, but the state of Tennessee overhauled its reading instruction. So did Mississippi. Not like what you expect.
No.
They overhauled their reading instruction, and the state of Tennessee has posted test score gains that put kids on par with 2019. So we're around the country, we got 3 years left of kids. Like, kids are making very slow gains, and they're going to be 3 years before they're all caught up.
Yep.
The kids in Tennessee are basically all caught up to where they were.
Wow. Just overhauling some of their reading curriculum.
And some there's tutoring in math. I mean, they're not keeping as close track as they should of what they're doing and why, but those are the results that they posted, and hopefully they'll hold up.
Wow. Okay. And last, that's really interesting. And the last thing that you said that I'll ask you about is, you know, you said some of the major overhaul is going to come for parents.
Yeah.
But sometimes I feel like so helpless, right? I'm one parent in a school district with thousands of kids in a state with hundreds of thousands of millions of kids in it. What are like two things I could do to have influence on what's happening in my own community?
Honestly, parents who show up to school board meetings have a really big voice. And I think we're all seeing that around the country.
Yes.
They're putting a lot of energy in. And I mean, it does take organizing and it takes help. But with a couple of parents on a Facebook group, you can have a big impact. And ask those questions. How are they spending that federal money? What is the plan for when it runs out? What is their hiring plan? You know, and it really just takes digging in and getting involved. I mean, for the better and for the worse, they are very democratic institutions, our school districts.
Yeah, they sure are. My daughter's in first grade. Let me tell you, I learned a lot last year. But I feel more prepared this year, having learned what I learned last year. And I agree. I think a board member or going to the board meetings, they have a lot of influence these days in your community. And that's mostly great, hopefully, right? I mean, that's good to be. Anya, I love the way you write. You obviously have a great mind for this, and you're curious, and I really enjoyed reading your book, and thank you for being with me today and sharing all this. I know you're so busy, and your book is coming out late August, and so where can people connect with you? Where can my listeners get your new book and connect with you?
The Stolen Year is available wherever books are sold. You can find me on Twitter at Anya1Anya. And I also have a monthly newsletter that I send out, AnyaKamenetz.net.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate you sharing all your insight with us today.
It was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening in today. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review us wherever you're listening to this podcast. Be sure to share with us on Instagram what you liked most about the episode by tagging me at Susanna.McMonagle. And lastly, if you want more information about the 5 to 8 shift, you can check out our website, the5to8shift.com. We'll see you guys next time.